Well, guys, did anybody else experience the day after the elections, or it was announced who had won, that you were a little tentative about asking people who they had voted for? Did you experience any of that at work or, among your
Well, I really didn't have to because Facebook told me, all my friends and which ones were excited and which ones were, going to protest. And I was really surprised at the polarity that was inside Facebook that next day.
Oh, I think everybody was surprised. And, our first guest.
Oh, yes.
It was actually changed his. He was doing the. He was actually supposed to do a keynote. It did do a keynote speech at Structure Conference and changed it a little bit based on the results.
Can you imagine being in the position that Brian Cantrill, he's the CTO at Joyent, found himself in? And Brian, thank you so much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor. It's delighted to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me. Great to be here.
How do you give a keynote speech to shell-shocked folks?
Oh, boy. Yeah, and especially when you yourself are shell-shocked. I kind of knew in the abstract that this was possible. I mean, I knew that this keynote had happened to land on the day after the election, and so I knew this was a possibility, if not something that felt very likely. And then, of course, we're on the West Coast, so we really knew the election results before going to bed. And so by 9, 10 p.m. Pacific, it was pretty clear what was happening. And, you obviously Michigan is much more closely divided than California is. In California, you really don't need to ask people who they support. And I'm in a precinct that that Clinton won by 80 points. I think everyone was shell shocked. Everyone really was. And I was kind of at this crossroads of I can't just give my stock state of the cloud kind of pitch.
And that was what you were lined up to do.
I was lined up to give a talk on the state of the cloud. And I was kind of reflecting for a little bit, and one of the things that's been exciting about this year is I've been traveling all over the country doing this Container Summit City Series, which has allowed me to get really local in a bunch of different places. Didn't make it to Detroit, but we made it to Milwaukee and Chicago, made it to St. Louis and Austin and Dallas, made it to a bunch of different places. And as I was kind of reflecting on my experience having done that, one of the themes that really came out from that, and certainly we've seen this here from our perch in Silicon Valley, but seeing it everywhere now, is the prophecy that Marc Andreessen, venture capitalist, made in 2011 in his famous and absolutely should be reread essay, Why Software is Eating the World. This is a Wall Street Journal essay he wrote. And we are seeing that come to fruition. Software is eating the world. And for me, and I think I dare say for us and for technologists in general, wherever you may live, this is exciting, software eating the world. This is economic disruption that is the lifeblood of innovation, coming out with a new idea and displacing old ways of doing it with a new and exciting way of doing it.
Well, and all of us technologists, we like disruption.
We love disruption.
But maybe some not so much.
Some not so much. And what you begin to realize is that, we don't just love disruption. We fetishize it. We seek it out.
Yes.
We are like those that have kind of the pathological love affair with fire and become arsonists. We love disruption, and you begin to realize, wait a minute, not everybody does. Disruption actually is disruptive. Man. Software is eating the world, and yet there are people, many people, that I think feel devoured. I think feel terrified by that. They feel eaten.
Brian, what we're going to do is take a quick pause here. When we come back, I want to unwrap some of this, talking about software eating the world and some of your other insights into disruption. But I can't help but feel this is kind of the way the world must have felt when it became clear that the internal combustion engine was going to change things radically. At the end of in the 1800s and going into the 1900s.
It just didn't happen overnight.
No,
that's the,
no.
That's the difference.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Literally.
With incredible speed that's going on right now. As I said, our guest is Brian Kentrell. He is the CTO at Joyent, and we're going to talk with him more about some of the insights in his speech that got changed rather radically on Wednesday.
Must have spent all night Wednesday rewriting
morning.
That.
I was going to say, how long? Yeah, he was up all night rewriting this. You're listening to the Internet Advisor, by the way. My name is Foster Brown, Gary Baker, Ed Riddell, and Cal Carson in-house here. We're delighted to be with you for this hour, and I hope you'll stay tuned and listen to a conversation about some of the huge changes that are taking place and trying to get some understanding about how we're going to survive all of this. That's all coming up this hour of the Internet Advisor. Thanks for joining us here on WJR. Welcome back. It's the Internet Advisor. And my name is Foster Brown, co-host and producer of the program, along with Gary Baker, Ed Riddell, and Cal Carson. Our guest is Brian Kentrell, who is the CTO at Joyent, which is a software container company. We'll talk about that a little bit more. But I would beg you, if you are saying, well, this is a little bit too technical for me, I think we're going to hit on some things that are really very, very much understood, particularly within the sound of our voices here in what's been called the Rust Belt, if you will, or an area that's been hit by disruption for a long time, Brian. It's not something brand new for us out here.
It sure isn't. No, it sure isn't. And I think, you know, one of the observations that I had that I think really stuck for a lot of people is that, you know, the fear that we had here in California on Wednesday morning, one of my observations was, I think that the fear that we had on Wednesday morning is the fear that's been felt for a generation in another
yes.
America.
Yes.
I think that that there's been a profound economic fear. I think there's been a lot of economic dislocation that's been going on for a long time. It's been going on, I think, at least for the last generation. And I think that that fear is becoming compounded. And I think what we saw was a political disruption. It was a message sent back that's saying, hey, not everybody is comfortable with this. And you know, to the credit of those that are uncomfortable, little effort has been made, honestly, to allow people to be comfortable, to get them comfortable with the pace of change.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, Foster found something online where they were talking about disruption.
Yes.
and you know, and he really and you saw this with Bernie Sanders on the left
mm-hmm.
and
yes.
Trump on the right, although it's hard to argue that Trump really is on the right, but whatever, right? When mm-hmm. this is not a political show, it's a technology show.
Gee,
but
I couldn't tell.
He really tapped into this trend that's been going on under the surface that Brian was just talking about. And Brian, how do you relate that back to what's going on with technology?
Well, I think that in technology, we've done this all the time, and we have disrupted ourselves all the time, and it has had human toll associated with it. But we have tend to internalize that. It's tend to have been, you know, and you can ask anyone who saw what happened to Route 128 in Massachusetts about technology's ability to disrupt itself when the epicenter for high-tech development moved from Massachusetts to Silicon Valley
mm-hmm.
In the 80s and 90s. So it's not like, I mean, tech is not immune to this at all.
No, not at all.
This is where it's been happening. To the contrary, it's been, I would say, somewhat isolated to technology. At least the pace has been isolated to the technology industry. And the big change is that now that pace of innovation has leapt out of technology into the much broader economy, and we are now seeing taxi companies, or the taxi industry,
yes.
mm-hmm. is being disrupted by a software company.
Yeah, Ed, it was interesting before when we were in the break there, you came back in and were saying, you know, I don't really know what all this has to do with anything, but
right.
I bet you do in terms of the changes that have taken place in technology and in people's lives and the jobs that are available to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now I do.
Well, think about disruption in manufacturing more than anything else that comes to mind for me. I mean, everybody wants it cheaper. Give it cheaper. And everything's been disrupted in this country where our manufacturing has been moved where? Basically to China.
Yeah, or Mexico.
Which is a huge disruption.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
The jobs have, but not always the technology that drives manufacturing.
And you know what's curious about this, too, I think in some ways, guys, is that, and we're seeing this, Brian, to some extent, that Detroit in some ways is or this Southeast Michigan is trying to take advantage of that disruption by creating a new, if you will, a new technology center.
Well, basically, we're disrupting Silicon Valley, taking part of their business and bringing it here.
That's right.
And, you know, I see that. And I see that from, I mean, cause I think that there is such great know-how in America, full stop. But the American spirit is, to me, about ingenuity and know-how. And I think you especially see that. That's got such deep roots in Southern Michigan. And I think that, if you talk to people in Silicon Valley, in Northern California, the number one complaint, I can tell you, is housing prices. And this area has become unlivable.
Yes.
For pretty basic definitions of livable. And, it does begin to force you to look elsewhere. And I think that, I mean, that there is a lot to be said. And you see some of this stuff in some of the movements in Detroit, and I think, you know, reclaiming some fallow property and turning it into maker spaces. I mean, there's a lot of exciting stuff that's happening, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that, and that to me, I do think that in all this disruption, I think we need to have a fundamental confidence in our ingenuity, in human ingenuity, but in American ingenuity in particular, that we've got a long history. We've survived a lot of big revolutions. I think, Foster, you were saying before the break about the internal combustion engine and the revolution from an agrarian economy to an industrialized one, I mean, which is surely a much bigger change. To go from being, 80% plus employed in an agrarian capacity to 80% plus employed in an industrial capacity in only, two generations or so.
Yeah. Cal, I think, hang on a second. Cal, I think you had a...
I think in some ways, we joke about stealing from Silicon Valley, but I would probably be more inclined to say, and you can agree or disagree with me on this particular point, rather than disruption, I think it creates eruption. In other places, things are starting to bubble up technology-wise in Detroit. It's going to start bubbling up more probably in the Atlanta area, that sort of thing. Mm. Different places of the country are going to erupt with more technology as a result of the disruption.
I absolutely agree, and that is in part because of some very disruptive trends that are happening in Silicon Valley. Cloud computing and open source together really allow you to disconnect geography from innovation.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's interesting, yeah.
Anyone, anywhere can spin up a compute cluster, can get the best software. I mean, one of the things that I was excited to see Google open source is this thing called TensorFlow, which is coming out of their Human Brain Initiative. They're beginning to use that for all their machine learning. It doesn't matter where you are. You can be a two-person shop in Detroit or Atlanta, and now you are benefiting from this best-of-breed technology. And this is a real fundamental difference between the industrial economy and the information economy, is that the cost of that software to you is zero. It's actually zero. It's not a manufactured good. It's information. And when your innovation is coming out of that information, to have zero cost means that there is no barrier to entry or low barrier. The barrier to entry is only your brain, which is a terrific opportunity, and I think actually does
that's
allow
the
for
challenge.
Many more people to participate.
I think that's the challenge, is that the brain now, rather than the strong back, becomes the real muscle.
What scares me, though, is whenever you say zero cost, it costs you nothing. I always think of the old adage, you get what you pay for. So how do you
variable
get the...
Variable cost is nothing.
Yeah, I think that might be a better call.
Well, so I would actually, I'd pull at that a bit, because I'm speaking now just about software, that the software that is available entirely open source is better than the software that you would pay a king's ransom for a generation ago.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So it's strictly in terms of software, in terms of the quality of the database that you get, the quality of the operating system, the quality of the services that you can build and you can use, it actually is pretty close to zero cost. I mean, obviously the cloud is not free, but the cloud is constantly disrupting itself. So it's pretty inexpensive, certainly much less expensive than it was a generation ago, to go from ideation to something that's actually operating.
Let me just reintroduce our guest here. This is Bryant Gantrill, who is a CTO at Joyent, and we're talking with him about some of the insights that he shared the very morning after the election to a group of technologists out in California. Go ahead, Cal.
So I guess my question to you, Brian, and it's really got me fascinated now, you talk so much about open source and some of it being even better than what you can buy. Does this mean that commercial software eventually is going to go away, and will the business environment embrace open source?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, and again, we have been disrupting our own here in metaphorical Silicon Valley for generations, and proprietary software has been thoroughly disrupted by open source software.
Mm.
And indeed, the feeling of economic dislocation is not unique to the middle of America. Mm. And there are plenty of people that work for software companies that are trying to figure out what their way is.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to take a quick pause, Brian, and just a moment we'll be right back with you. Brian Cantrill from Joyn Software. I'm going to talk about AI and what impact that's going to have in the future.
I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Wonderful line from Peter Finch, delivered that line in the movie Networking many, many years ago.
Yes, he did.
But in many ways, I think...
A lot of people did that
this
exactly last week.
That's exactly what people did on Election Day in the U.S. They essentially stuck their heads out of their metaphorical windows and said, that's it. We are mad as hell about this, and we want something to be changed. Our guest with us right now is Brian Cantrill, who found himself in an interesting situation of delivering a keynote speech the morning after the election, and everybody is kind of agog about what happened, but trying to make some sense of it. And Brian, thank you very much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor.
Well, thanks again for having me.
You know, one of the things I saw down here in a comment that was made was that we're living through a period of tremendous economic and workforce disruption, and the future of software and artificial intelligence is only going to accelerate that. Many more types of jobs will be put at risk and new opportunities will open. Talk a little bit about the impact of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and I think that artificial intelligence gets, I mean, I hate the label artificial intelligence,
right,
because
mm-hmm.
it has such human connotations.
Mm.
And I think that that naturally gets people nervous, especially non-technologists.
Mm-hmm.
Computational technology is not on a human trajectory at all. We are, the so-called strong AI, actually giving a machine truly human characteristics, is no further along now than it was 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very important that we not think of this as kind of artificial human intelligence. But I do think what we are doing, and we have done pretty successfully, or are doing successfully, is mimicking some of the baser levels of the brain. So we are mimicking the visual cortex. And that is becoming increasingly effective.
That's like a machine vision, you mean, kind of thing?
Like machine vision. And yep. You know, Andrew Ng, who's a professor at Stanford, phrased this. He had a great Harvard Business Review piece a couple days ago. And I really like the way he phrased it. And that is that if a typical person can do a mental task with less than 1 second of thought, that is probably a candidate to be automated.
Mm.
So
yep.
If it's taking you less than a second, because you think about driving. I mean, you don't actually, I mean, part of the problem is we don't think enough about driving, right?
That's true.
Your mind is wandering, or you're texting, or what have you. But, I mean, clearly this is not exacting a high mental toll. So driving is a candidate to be automated. You know, if you are, you know, if you're on a production line looking for defects of a product as it goes past, like that is a candidate for automating. But we are not automating creativity. We are not automating the ability to, you know, create art or music or teach mm-hmm. or care for one another or crack a joke or even actually really truly make sense of language. I mean, you look at
yes.
the computational linguistics is still using some kind of hacky techniques. So yes, it's actually coming, but I think we need to be careful about what it can and can't do.
Mm.
You know, you were talking about open source, and we haven't talked a little bit about your background, but you served as a distinguished engineer at Sun Microsystems.
That's right. A company that was so thoroughly disrupted that the building that I came up in when I was a young engineer is now in the Facebook campus.
Mm.
And to just show you how much we fetishize disruption in Silicon Valley, Facebook deliberately did not change the names of the buildings to serve as a chilling warning to Facebookers that this is the fate that awaits Silicon Valley companies. It just shows you how screwed up we are in Silicon Valley.
But, you know, you think about it, and Sun has a very big open source footprint, or did have a very big open source footprint with Java, and he was trying to disintermediate and disrupt an awful lot of other proprietary software, right?
And it did, successfully.
Yeah, very successful.
And, you know, as always happens, you know, the disruptor becomes disrupted around here. That is just, the, I mean, that is the life cycle. And,
yeah.
I mean, you can't be too smug when you're on one side of that, because you'll be on the other side before
you know
it. Oh,
boy, that is really
interesting. You know, I do want to mention something. Since you have a little bit of history with Sun, on the same day that Scott McNeely, who is the founder and longtime CEO of Sun, on the same day in June of 93, when he graduated from high school at Losher and 17 Mile Road, just up the road from us, Brian, 4 miles down the road at Losher and 13 Mile, we had Steve Ballmer graduating. Yeah. From high school.
There you go.
And when you think about those two companies, Steve Ballmer running Microsoft for so long after Bill Gates stepped aside, those two guys went after each other all the time, and they graduated 4 miles away from each other.
Right.
Well, and I don't necessarily think that that's a coincidence. I know I imagine for Steve, his parents were in the auto industry. Certainly for Scott, his father was in the auto industry, and that absolutely played a role in who Scott was and the way who Scott is and the way he thinks about things. So I don't think that that's a coincidence that you saw that kind of that Michigan diaspora inventing the next wave.
Brian Kentrell, let's step for just a minute. We've got not much time before we have to step out of here for My Tech News coming up with Mike Brennan. But let's apply this now to Donald Trump, the president-elect. What kind of relationship do you think he will have with Silicon Valley, which has been that huge engine of disruption in many ways in our culture so far?
Yeah, boy. I think that part of the challenge with Trump as a candidate is it's very hard to get a bead on how much of this rhetoric is serious and how much of it is rhetoric.
Mm.
Certainly there are things that are extremely important to Silicon Valley and not just Silicon Valley, but to innovation full stop, that we really don't want to tamper with. I mean, an issue that's a hot issue for us, but for perhaps different reasons than the rest of the country, is immigration. Anyone who's been in this industry, probably in Southern Michigan as well, has worked with an immigrant who's done unbelievable work, who's added terrific value to this economy, this country, or their company. We have to keep that lifeblood.
And we can't find enough really good trained people.
It's not even just training. It is that this kind of exceptional creativity happens everywhere. And it's I have found, and I've been lucky enough to find, that the people who are from the rest of the world come here still, even still. They come here because here's where they want to innovate. And in terms of my fears for a Trump administration, we must not derail that. We must keep that unbelievable mantle that we have preserved of the world's innovation. And so that would be my biggest concern. I'm hoping that he's just going to make, Barron is going to be like Secretary of Xbox, and he's going to rename Yosemite Trump National Park, and we'll be done with it.
Great. There goes my operating system on my Mac. But you know, in all seriousness, when you really sit down and think about it, we've elected Trump as president, and we haven't elected him as king. And with the checks and balances between the other branches of our government, he's going to have to be somewhat in the center anyway when it's all said and done. And so I don't think we have a lot of threat that we have to worry about. He can't close the borders, and it would be not advisable to do such a thing, because we need the total diversity of the world to be able to do the innovations of the world.
I think you're right, and I do actually ultimately share that confidence. I do share the confidence that we do have the checks and balances. I think he's going to be very bored by governing. Governing is really kind of a boring process. Very detail-oriented.
Yeah,
so
it sure is.
He may find, even in his speech, when he was talking about like 2 to 3 years, it's like, you do know you're in here for 4, right?
You know, Brian, I think this disruption, the technology roadmap is just going to continue. And tell us a little bit about Joyent, because, boy, talking about a disruptive technology.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're a cloud computing company. We've been a cloud computing company before there was cloud, since 2004. And we have had we've got our own open source stack. And the thing that we were really earliest on was the container revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So for your listeners, that cloud computing has historically been based on virtual machines. And a virtual machine is really a virtual personal computer in a very literal sense. It is the personal computer architecture from IBM in Boca Raton in 1979 mm-hmm. that we are running in Amazon. And what Joyent saw is the ability we saw is moving to a much lighter weight virtualization around a container, which is much more tightly wrapped around the application. You can get much more efficiency and so on. And the container revolution, we were way too early to the container revolution, which is really not necessarily that much fun. You just sound like a crazy person for a period of time. But the container revolution has now fully arrived, and which we're very excited about. We've been really kind of leveraging that, things like technologies like Docker, which we've been very excited about. And ultimately, so in June, we were actually bought by Samsung, which I also think is a sign of the times.
Well, Brian, I'm sorry, the music tells me we're on our way out of here right now, but I want to thank you very much for stepping in and sharing your insights with us. And Brian Cantrill has been our guest here, CTO at Joyent, and we'll
look
be back.
That firm up.
We'll be back in just a minute.